Hello and welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, a service of the Iris Network. My name is Randy Labar. I am reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes. Copyright 2005 by Hannah Holmes and published by Bloomsbury Publishing, New York, New York. In the last episode, the author was continuing to examine the structure of the soil in her yard. We continue with Suburban Safari on page 99, and this is episode 10. For my next digging site, I choose a patch of dead grass where a dog has peed. I don't dig far. The roots are as dead as the tops. The handful of sandy dirt smells sour. I pop it under the microscope for a better view. The roots look dry and yellow, like day-old macaroni. The dust around them blows in gusts of wind. It's so dark and uniform that I think it might be eggs, but when I boost the magnification, the dust resolves into nodules of soil. Glinting bits of quartz cling together with brown and rust-colored particles. Nothing else moves. Nitrogen, which in small doses is the elixir of many plants, has burned this soil. Nitrogen is one of those things that, like water, can be your best pal or your fellest foe. Although it makes up 78% of air, it's a form that plants can't use. In days of yore, a hungry plant had to rely on soil bacteria to produce reactive nitrogen. In the temperate regions of the world, nitrogen was in such short supply that it was the limiting factor on the total tonnage of green things that could grow. The industrial era changed that. In the past 150 years, we've multiplied the world's budget of reactive nitrogen 15-fold. The biggest source is synthetic fertilizer, which both rises off and runs off farms and lawns. Another one-third is made by bacteria that cohabitate with nitrogen fixer crops, and by the burning of fossil fuels in cars and factories. Lesser sources include sewage, especially when the makers of the sewage, Atkins dieters take note, eat lots of protein. Cows are prodigious nitrogen emitters, too. You'd think this flood of nitrogen into the soil would be an unmitigated blessing, but it's mitigated. For starters, not every plant likes nitrogen, so if you add it to a landscape, you tilt the competition for sunlight and minerals towards nitrogen lovers. Studies on plots of land where nitrogen is added demonstrate that a few nitrophiles thrive, shading the majority of plants into extinction. Under natural conditions, nitrogen falling with the rain onto my lawn would be massaged by plants and bacteria into an acidic, reactive form. But pour too much nitrogen into the system, and the soil becomes too acidic. This offends many plants. It also speeds the loss of important minerals from the soil. In the nitrogen-acidified water, they dissolve and wash into the nearest water body. When I visited Katalin Slavich in Baltimore, I also stopped by the office of Rich Poyot, who's up to his ears in the Baltimore Long-Term Ecosystem Research Project. Rich, and a cast of dozens, will keep tabs on ecosystem indicators over many years to spot trends in urban nature. Rich has been looking at how urban lawns compare to farms and forests, in terms of how readily they leak nitrogen. Peculiar news. Converting farms to lawns can be a net improvement when it comes to nitrogen pollution. Agricultural soil is, in fact, extremely leaky, says Rich. He's a brick of a guy whose office is stacked with books and backpacking gear. Forests suck up nitrogen very efficiently, he explains. You end up with those clean mountain streams, but not on farms. The reason is unknown, but it could be that plowing disrupts the fungi that should be capturing nitrogen. It could be that overworked farm soil runs low on the organic carbon that nitrogen-fixing bacteria require. Or it could be that in addition to menacing forests, earthworms are also ruining farms. Earthworms complicate the nitrogen picture. The environment created by earthworms encourages the profusion of a kind of bacteria that converts soil nitrogen to a water-soluble form. This kind of nitrogen quickly washes out of soil. The result is leaky soil, and leaking nitrogen is a bad thing. When it hits a water body, it feeds an algae bloom. The ensuing algae demise sucks oxygen out of water. Fish die. Or, if the high nitrogen water washes around a coral reef, it nourishes algae that smother coral. Coral die. Fish that require coral for food and shelter die. An earthworm can cast a long shadow. Whether it's earthworms, plowing, or bacteria that make farms so leaky, it's too early to say, but right now, the farm is making the lawn look good. The lawn falls in between forest and agricultural soils, Rich says. It leaks, but not as much as we thought. This analysis is preliminary, and the conclusions could change. For the moment, however, in the category of polluting the water with nitrogen, the lawn can lord it over the farm. Well, except for those lawns that get overdosed with fertilizer, or on which a dog pees. The Baltimore work has shown that lawn soils also host more microbes than farms do. That's a good thing, especially because some microbes can break down pollutants that lurk in more urban soils. Lawns also boast more worms and more pill bugs and sow bugs, all of whom turn old vegetation into soil. And in contrast to forests, the plants and microbes in towns and cities may be able to consume much of that leaking nitrogen that worms over-encourage. The final hole I dig is in a shaded patch that's surviving the drought. Up comes a plug of tangled roots and the smell of dirt. Under the microscope, these roots look as moist as fresh-cooked spaghetti. Still, something's missing. Between the drought and the season, the soil is devoid of all the creepy crawlies who should be squirming through it. Where are the larvae of Japanese beetles and rose chafers? Shouldn't they be gnawing on the grass roots? By now, Japanese beetle mothers should have buried dozens of eggs, and the young grubs should be killing grass like crazy. Perhaps my skunks have hunted down every one. In any case, the soil ought to be jittery with tiny mites, springtails, and other little earth workers who travel the worm trails and pore spaces of soil. Nematodes, a family of tiny worms who prey on everything from roots to root-eating insects, should be insinuated among the clover roots. But it has been horribly dry. Fungi must still be swarming through this sample, but they're too fine to see. I get enigmatic greetings from my soil fungi when mushrooms pop out of the lawn. Like the tips of icebergs, mushrooms are mere fruiting bodies that rise from a hidden organism. Some underground fungal colonies cover acres. The first mushrooms to surface in my yard outlined a more modest support system. A ring of oystery caps circled an apple stump, suggesting that the colony was dining on dead apple roots. But the occasional singleton, who raises his head as the summer progresses, is more intriguing. Is the odd greenish mushroom the sole fruit of a small colony? Or is he the achievement of an organism who underlies my entire neighborhood? The bacteria in the soil are likewise beyond my ken. From what I've read, they're present in this clot of roots in the kind of numbers only astrophysicists comprehend. Several billion per square yard. Depending on your definition of several, that's a minimum of 2 million bacteria per square inch, or 8 to 10 million in my hand. How many am I crushing under my feet at this minute? How many each time I mow the lawn? I push the plug of soil back into its hole. My palms are dirty. More will die. The dimensions of my crime are astronomical. My ribboned leaf and apple will endure until they're covered in snow. The apple will shrink to 1/3 its original size by the end of September, then 1/4 by December. It will turn corky and tough. Most of its moisture will have escaped into the air or into the guts of worms, ants, and beetles. When I lift it to check its underside, ice crystals will have formed between apple and soil. More crystals will be rupturing cells inside the punky fruit. The ribboned leaf, downed in its prime by squirrel teeth, will lose more of its bitter tannin than the leaves that tumble down naturally in early winter. By snowfall, someone will have munched two big holes in it, chewing right through the tough veins. It'll be about 20% recycled. By next spring, the eaten leaf tissue and the apple pulp, the dead roots and rotting worms, the sacrificed Norway maple sprouts, and even a few molecules of beer can, all will be contributing to a new round of life. Chapter 6. The Freedom Lawn. On a sticky morning, when clots of sea fog are trailing across the yard, I look out to see three of my crows lying in the grass. Their wings are spread wide. Heaven help us, have we got West Nile? They shudder in turns. Their feathers flutter against the ground. Then they bob their heads. They're not dying, they're bathing. I've seen them flap in the wet grass before, but this morning there has been no rain. My subsequent investigation convinces me that they're medicating themselves with my lawn plants. Plant medicines are well known in the animal kingdom. Overpregnant African elephants eat the same plant that their human neighbors eat to induce labor. Grizzly bears rub their faces with a chewed-up root whose compounds may function as bug repellent. A Costa Rican monkey treats its fur with three of the same plants that the people around them use on their skin. For that matter, crows are known to engage in anting, whereby they crush ants and rub them through their feathers, presumably exploiting the formic acid in one insect to drive away another. But I haven't noticed anthills in the part of the yard where my crows are fluttering. What else could inspire a crow to bathe? I think it's time to survey my lawn from front to back and see exactly what it's made of. Already I've determined that this lawn is on the cutting edge of turf management. It's a delicately balanced mixture of whatever can grow in any particular spot and doesn't mind getting whacked by the mower every couple of weeks. The lawn industry term for this landscaping scheme is Freedom Lawn, capitalized by its coiners. The freedom applies both to the plants and the people, the latter of whom needn't water, fertilize, pesticides, or otherwise interfere. Nurseries now sell Freedom Lawn seed mixes for landowners who live in parts of the world that have been shortchanged in weeds. But even before I came across the official term, I thought of my yard as a Darwin lawn. Whatever could survive the mower and the drought was welcome to stay. Whatever you call it, it's a popular landscape choice around here. Maine has been slow to recognize the genius of turning a perfectly good vegetable patch with garbage dump into an outdoor shag rug. And if we must have a shag rug outdoors, by gory, we ain't gonna manicure the blasted thing. So I and all my immediate neighbors have freedom lawns, which is just to say that a crawl across my lawn is going to be more like rambling across a diverse continent rather than walking through a tree farm. My Freedom Lawn contains the miniature equivalents of a jungle and a savanna, a prairie and a pine forest. It's eye-blurring hot today, though. I'll crawl across the lawn later. Right now, I'll take my books under the umbrella on the deck and read about the history of backyard grass farming. Everyone's feeling floppy today. A squirrel spread-eagles himself on the shaded grass. When the turf warms up, or his belly stops cooling down, he drags himself forward to a fresh spot and flops again. The American lawn, in a nutshell, is a sterilized version of an English pasture. The French invented the lawn proper, but their turf was just another element of color and texture to deploy in the geometry of a formal garden. In the 1700s, English landscape architects began to veer off the garden path. The French tradition was a bit too urban for the evolving English view. The English view was that one visited one's country house to get a view, the vista in the metropolis having been obliterated by grime. And so in front of a house in the country, the English lawn was born. More accurately, the lawn was renamed. It was there already, in that the house was surrounded by something called a sheep pasture. But the fencing that kept the sheep from running off was considered detrimental to the view. This problem was solved, and the ideal lawn invented in 1690. That was the year the ha-ha was born. The ha-ha was a ditch dug at a special angle. From the perspective of a sheep, the ditch appeared to have a fence leaning against its far side. But from the house, from the perspective of the guy who paid the landscape architect's bill, the lawn now looked like an open pasture that rolled to the horizon. Ha ha! This became the lingua franca of landscapes. The lawn evolved under the hand of Lancelot Brown, who so often referred to a landscape's capabilities that he became known as Capability Brown. In flat pastures, Capability saw the potential for smooth rolling hills, and he hired laborers to reveal it. His famous lawns, some still grace English houses today, romanticized the stuffing out of nature. By Capability's time, English nature had been deforested and overgrazed, but never mind that. Capability's pasture lawns ebbed and flowed around intrusions of forest. He was always willing to eliminate a village or dismiss a formal row of old trees if it facilitated the land's self-actualization. So the lawn became a sculptural landscape inspired by artistic interpretations of the pasture and forest combo. The lawn came to North America in roughly the same steps, first as pasture, then as artistic statement. When the English brought their livestock to the East Coast, they found the native grasses less nutritious than the grass back home. Plus, many native grasses were annuals, so if the livestock ate the seed heads in the summer, the next spring's grass crop were sparse. By the mid-1600s, settlers were importing clover, Kentucky bluegrass, and other European pasture seeds. The native grasses were overrun. In California, the native bunch grasses met a similar fate when the Spanish and their cows arrived in the 1700s. Mediterranean grasses now dominate that landscape. In the south, the African species Guinea grass and Bermuda grass were running rampant by the early 1800s. And by the end of that century, Canada's bunch grasses were yielding to imported timothy, alfalfa, clover, and other cow fatteners. As in England, the pasture evolved into a lawn when it rubbed up against a fancy house. George Washington had a ha-ha at Mount Vernon, along with a vast lawn mowed by deer. Thomas Jefferson, who admired Capability's work in England, transported the aesthetic to Monticello. He, too, had a ha-ha. Both these revolutionary gents relied on plants native to Mother England to green their swards, and both spent tons of money to exploit the capabilities of their estates. Most people didn't have money to throw away digging ha-has and pasturing deer. A typical front yard was more likely to feature bare or weedy earth with a border of flowers or shrubs. Particularly in the South, a dooryard of packed earth was a practical defense against snakes. The backyard was thoroughly utilitarian. It held a vegetable patch, chickens, berries, fruit trees, perhaps a cow, and certainly a rubbish heap. It's interesting to me that the rubbish heap in my own backyard has remained in the same place through 85 years and numerous tenants. Recent owners piled old lumber, aluminum tent poles, and plastic milk crates in the same spot that early owners tossed their busted crockery, cans, and glass. Guided by who knows what instinct, I located my compost bin in there, too. More than a century passed before the average person could be badgered into beautifying the front yard a la Jefferson and Washington. It did take some badgering. Lawning was hard. The grasses people were urged to cultivate evolved in the rainy, cool climate of England. North Americans, who didn't live in a rainy, cool area, were hard-pressed to keep the stuff alive. They got iffy advice. One author directed people to sprinkle a failing lawn with salt and plaster. According to Virginia Scott Jenkins, author of The Lawn, A History of an American Obsession. And they had no lawn mowers. But when people dispersed from cities to the new suburbs a century ago, they capitulated. In the suburbs, a man's home was his castle. And these suburban and village castles, the arbiters of fashion urged, ought to be miniature versions of Monticello and Mount Vernon. In the 1920s and 30s, the pro-lawn propaganda poured forth from garden clubs that were popping up like daisies on a dunghill, and these lawn enthusiasts had something to offer the beleaguered homeowner. The seeds had improved, at no small expense to the taxpayer. The Agriculture Department, in cooperation with the U.S. Golf Association, had tried to find a grass for every climate and condition. The feds had given some thought to fertilizer, too. The era of spreading manure, not to mention plaster, on the lawn was fading. The lawnmower had likewise matured. The first American brands, introduced in the late 1800s, probably compared favorably to the sheep, the scythe, and the horse-drawn mower, but they were nonetheless weighty, unwieldy, and unpopular. By the turn of the century, Sears, Roebuck & Company offered four models at a modest $2.85, according to The Lawn. A newfangled bicycle was going for about $12. Furthermore, rubber hoses and sprinklers had been invented. Lawn rollers, fertilizer spreaders, and other aids were appearing, too. The lawn was putting down roots. So, to recap once more, immigrants brought European pasture plants to North America to feed their livestock. Wealthy Americans used those plants to imitate the lawns of wealthy Englishmen. The average homeowner imitated this imitation only when it became cheap and sort of easy to do so. Then we imitated with a vengeance. The lawn became de rigueur, not only in North America's moist climates, but even in blazing deserts, where a regimen of heroic measures are necessary to keep grass alive. There were holdouts. There are still. New Englanders have a powerful immunity to fashion epidemics. Like rural people everywhere, I suppose, we stuck to our pragmatic landscape designs even when we migrated into the suburbs. To this very day in my almost urban neighborhood, the occasional yard still functions as a site for lobster trap storage and or parts vehicles and or a vegetable garden. and I doubt I'm the only person on the block who flips my floor sweepings under the shrubbery or heaves rotten fruit out for the vermin, just as our ancestors threw spoiled beans and broken plates out the back door. And as I mentioned, most of us balked at striving for the current fashion, which dictates that grass alone belongs in a lawn. Yes, it was not enough for a lawn to be rolling and green. As early as 1897, a USDA scientist was promoting lawns grown from a single grass species, and from which any intruding invader should be plucked, Jenkins writes in The Lawn. Clover held its own for a few more decades, but the writing was on the wall. The lawn would become a grass farm with all the weeding, watering, and fertilizing that any farm crop entails. Monocultures are sickly. That's a scientific fact. While it's true that some plants fight each other, it's also true that a high diversity of plants protects everybody. Together, the plants pool their talents. Each plant probably repels a few harmful insects. Each probably attracts a beneficial insect or two. The wastes of one species feed the roots of the next. The bold produce shade for the shy. They also dilute themselves, making it tougher for diseases to roll from clover to clover or ryegrass to ryegrass. This has been proven in experiments. A plot of grassland hosting many species produces a lot more greenery than a plot with fewer species. Even the most carefully tended plot of a single species can't compete. And so, grass farming remains a struggle, even with all the chemicals. Replacing a mixture of robust plants with one or two species of grass is something like flattening a rainforest to plant corn. It can be done, but the law of the jungle will be against you every step of the way. Leafcutter ants will file in to snip up your corn. You'll blast them with pesticide. This will kill some of the beneficial insects you hoped would defend your corn. The soil, deprived of dead leaves, monkey manure, and ant tunnels, will soon wear out. The next time you buy pesticide, you'll buy fertilizer, too. The next year, you'll buy it again. And again. You're addicted. The fertilizer pushers are happy, though. In the United States, we spend more money growing grass than any other crop, according to the authors of Redesigning the American Lawn. Perhaps this is to be expected, since home lawns cover more acres of the United States than any other crop. Turfed roadsides, cemeteries, golf courses, and the like push the total higher. Well, that's all we have time for on this edition of The Maine Reader. We are reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes. This is The Maine Reader on Maine Airs. My name is Randy LaBarre. Thank you for listening.